Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 30th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Making Christian Sense of Contemporary Popular Music. I sing in the reaches when non-religious songs do the work of God. Presented by Peter Mercer Taylor. Disc number MEP 2005-10.
For those of you who have not seen me before in one of these sessions, and most of you look like familiar faces, I'm Peter Mercer Taylor, here from the University of Minnesota, where I teach in the School of Music. I am a music historian, and at the University of Minnesota, I teach classes on popular music and on classical music, both roughly divided down the middle. My commitments lately have actually been mostly to rock music. And after about 14 years of working on Felix Mendelssohn as a scholar, I have now turned my attentions almost entirely away from classical music in a scholarly way and toward popular music, and I'm in the midst of several sort of pop music-related scholarly projects that I would be pleased to talk with any or all of you about more after this session, if you can do it for 45 minutes, because I'm getting on the 10:45 bus. But it's been a wonderful week, and I want to begin today just by saying, again, most of you have been in these sessions before. Many of you have contributed to these sessions, and I really did not know what to expect coming to Holden Village to work through this comparatively untested material. As you can imagine, at a place like the University of Minnesota, this kind of course is not precisely what one is invited to do, to teach about, say, rock and Christianity. Rock, everybody wants to hear about. Christianity, not such a hot seller at a place like the University of Minnesota. In fact, more or less forbidden ground. And it's a wonderful thing to be invited to a place where I can run over a certain kind of concern that tends to haunt my rock-oriented classes at the U, but try to meld it with this other set of concerns, those of Christianity and the Christian worldview, that really have no place in a public university, and I think rightly probably have no place in a public university. If you disagree, that can be part of what we discuss. But today I want to wrap up things with a fairly casual set of examinations of hopefully three songs, if we have time to get to three songs. We have wandered around a set of issues in the course of this week, from those songs that deal with, say, redemption or with the afterlife in ways that are not explicitly religious but seem to parallel concerns that Christians have. We've dealt with songs that handle God himself, yet in a sort of comical way, as a sort of novelty song subject, in the work of Elvis Costello, of Crash Test Dummies, of Joan Osborne. And in our last session, we dealt with songs that make explicit use of religious imagery just in various ways, that allude to biblical narratives in one way or another, to the locust wind of U2's Bullet the Blue Skies, or to the sort of mysterious Joseph of Paul Simon's Under African Skies, different ways in which biblical narratives appear to be addressed in certain popular songs with greater or less sincerity, with greater or less depth or sort of richness in terms of their exploration of what the relevance of the biblical narrative might be. Today we're taking another step back and exploring two songs by an artist named Sarah McLachlan, and if we have time, one song by an artist named Moby. And in a sense, the concerns that we're setting before us this morning are the fuzziest set of concerns that we've had yet. What I want to explore are songs, these three in particular, songs which appear in some meaningful, purposeful way to assume a kind of moral high ground. And what I've tried to describe this as, in just sort of writing up a description of the blurb for this session today, is songs that seem to do the work of God, songs that seem to do religious work, despite the fact that they're purely secular songs. And none of the songs today make any mention, well, one mentions Jesus once, but in a sort of fleeting way, as you'll see. None of the songs really positions itself as a specifically religious song, a Christian song from a Christian subject position doing Christian work, yet they all, in their way, seem to be doing a work that a Christian would look at and say, ah yes, this is, at least in part, the work of Christianity or the work of God. And in order to do these songs, to do this work, these songs have to assume a kind of moral high ground. They have to assume a kind of moral credibility and an ethical credibility. And in a sense, what I want to explore today is this highly intangible question of just how a pop song goes about establishing moral credibility. And Sarah McLachlan, for example, again, we're dealing with two songs of hers. Sarah McLachlan is a fascinating artist, fascinating not only in the extent and the scope of her popularity about 5 years ago, after her album Surfacing came out, but in the nature of that popularity, that people had a way of dealing with Sarah McLachlan not just as fans, but as true believers, in a way that not all that many artists, I think, have attracted attention. She was popularly known back in those days as the Goddess. If you were going to go to a concert and you said, I'm going to go to a concert by the Goddess, everybody would know who you were talking about. You're talking about Sarah McLachlan. Sarah McLachlan fans would know who you were talking about. And this is how they spoke among one another. Now, the image of the pure woman in particular, the woman who is morally pure, ethically, utterly unimpeachable, that she is a person who could be presented on stage and captured in music, is certainly an ancient idea. It goes back to the beginnings of opera and before. But if we think, for example, about the Julie Andrews character in The Sound of Music, you know, what makes this Julie Andrews character operate? What makes Maria who she is? Well, it is in part the fact that she is this nun, the fact that she obviously is, and I assume most of us have seen The Sound of Music or are familiar with the story, that she is certainly morally unimpeachable, that her integrity cannot be questioned, her moral authority can't be questioned. And the things that we need Julie Andrews to do to get this point across, Julie Andrews, the actress, sort of bringing Maria to life, we need her to be, among other things, a wonderful singer. She has to have great physical beauty, which, for better or worse, is one sort of nexus of the cinematographic representation of purity, of moral purity, but she also has to have a pure voice. She also has to have a beautiful voice. And in one of my favorite scenes in Cinderella, for example, Disney's Cinderella, now a 65-year-old movie, there's this wonderful scene in which there's about a 90-second musical number that doesn't have much to do with anything except that it's a number that begins in a performance by the two evil stepsisters upstairs. They're beginning this performance of saying, sweet nightingale, oh, sweet nightingale. It's a ridiculous song. It's a terrible song. But the stepsisters are up there, and one of them's playing the flute, and one of them's singing, and it's a horrible sound. The flute player can't play the flute. The singer's just kind of screeching along. Their mother is doing their best to make it work, but it doesn't. But the camera, as it were, the invisible camera sort of sweeps us out the door. We actually follow Lucifer the cat down the stairs. Lucifer can't stand the sound of the stepsisters singing this song, so Lucifer the cat walks out the door, slams the door, and downstairs Cinderella is singing the same song. And as you would expect, Cinderella sings it beautifully. And this is a little sort of, signifier for the nature. It's a clue. It's a sort of metaphoric, glimpse into the nature of her soul, into the nature of her moral purity. We believe that if somebody sings beautifully, she or he is, and especially she, morally pure. And this is something that we take for granted. Now, Sarah McLachlan is a beautiful human being. This is, in part what she's paid for, the singer of these songs. Videos just tend to kind of linger on her face. Which is certainly a beautiful face. There are no two ways about that. And that is part of the package. And again, for better or worse, female performers of music simply don't tend to make it unless they are stunningly beautiful creatures in a way that men apparently don't have to be stunningly beautiful creatures. And this just is the way the industry has always worked, and there's no great surprise there, perhaps, though there's something of a tragedy, maybe. But Sarah McLachlan, I submit, is doing something by way of updating this old tradition that Julie Andrews is tapping into in The Sound of Music, that Cinderella was tapping into before, that Agatha was tapping into in Weber's Der Freischütz in 1821, an old sort of German romantic opera about sort of good and evil pitted against one another. And Agatha, the heroine of that opera, was always going around sort of singing prayers and things, and she had this sort of lilting, beautiful voice. And we can take things back to the 17th century if we like. This model of the morally pure woman whose purity we become aware of in the course of the nature of the music that she makes. Sarah McLachlan, I think, has done a very interesting job of kind of updating that image for the present day. And the two songs of Sarah McLachlan I want to listen to today, the first, Adia, the second, Building a Mystery, both assume a kind of moral high ground. They both undertake a kind of religious work. Or work that we Christians might sort of perceive to be religious work. In the first case, it's a work of sort of exculpation, a work of forgiveness, that we get around to the chorus of this song, and she is trying to convince this person, Adia, that she's talking to, we're born innocent. Believe me, Adia, we're still innocent. And we don't quite know what the situation is. I gather that the historical fact of this song is that it was inspired by and written for a friend who is a child abuse survivor, a survivor of sexual abuse, for whom Sarah McLachlan wrote this song, or at least by whom this song is inspired. And although there aren't that many clues in the unfolding of the lyrics, that's what the song is about. And it is in fact treacherous to say that the song is about the thing that inspired it. At least we can sort of take that thought to the bank as we get into the chorus of this thing. You know, we're born innocent, believe me, we are still innocent. And in a sense, this sort of lifting of sins, the washing away of sins, obviously has strong resonances with certain Christian practices. And although there is nothing Christian about this song, it's a Christian maneuver that she's making. And what I want to ask here is, what's going on musically to make this possible for her? That is, that we can go into church, and if we hear sort of highfalutin, you know, great Christian music, we go listen to a Passion by Bach, we understand, oh yes, this is music that simply has a kind of moral high ground. We can hear this is simply divinely inspired. It's simply divine music. And even when Bach is writing secular music, even when he's writing instrumental music, we still can be inclined, if we're of that persuasion, to see God everywhere, to think that it's simply divinely infused, and almost certainly divinely inspired music. And in a sense, Sarah McLachlan does exactly the same job, that we listen to her sing this song and we just believe it. And again, it's an intangible thing, the way that she makes us through this chorus, what exactly she offers us, but we just believe it. We think, yes, Sarah McLachlan has the power to do this forgiveness thing that she's doing. She has that power to wash away sins somehow. We simply must believe her. And the question is, what's pop music doing that makes that possible? What is the seat of pop music's power when it lays claim to this kind of moral authority? I won't say too much more about this song before we listen to it. It's a fairly straightforward song. I want to call your attention to one sort of curious thing that happens. In general, I invite you not to read the lyrics ahead of time, but in this case, I want to allude to the lyrics because I think they can help us sort of get oriented within the song. The first verse, Adia, I do believe I failed you. I know I let you down. Don't you know I tried so hard to love you in my way? It's easy, let it go. This is the first verse. We get a second verse before our first big chorus. Adia, I'm empty since you left me, trying to find a way to carry on. Reading down a bit, we get into the chorus. We're born innocent. Believe me, Adia, we're still innocent. It's easy, we all falter. Doesn't matter. And then into the second verse. And five lines into the second verse, something very special happens. When she says, I pull you from your tower, I take away your pain. I pull you from your tower, I take away your pain. Show you all the beauty you possess if you'd only let yourself believe. However it goes at that point. But when she gets to this part, I pull you from your tower, we get, for example, her voice going, ha, ha, ha. Ha, this sort of sound of this ha, over and over again. And it goes straight through to the moment that the chorus begins. Now this is a detail. I mean, that is, it's probably just some idea that her producer had. You know, let's sort of stick in this funny sort of ha 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 thing at this point. It'll just be neat. It'll kind of enrich the texture. This is a production detail of the kind that we expect of contemporary pop music. It's sort of richly produced music, thoughtfully produced music, with all kinds of just little neat stuff happening all the time. But it's this kind of detail I invite you to kind of focus your attention on. What are the features of the production itself, of the sound itself, that seem to be channeling our confidence in certain ways? And whether you can make sense of those ha's or not, the reason I bring them up is that that's the level of listening that I hope we can accomplish here, is just what. How is this thing produced? What are the details? Not necessarily the way the pitches go together, but the way the whole sound is put together, the way her voice sounds, the quality of instrumentation, details of production. What's going into the generation of the kind of mystery of this, the kind of mystical sense that she has the moral authority to do this very serious work which she's undertaking? Let's give it a listen. Thank you. me say about this song? I've certainly got more to say, but I'd rather hear from you all first. How does the thing work? What works about it? Or does it work? Is there anybody who listens to this thing and then is thinking to him or herself, I don't have the first idea what he's talking about. There's no more for you there.
I'll temper this to say that I was a CPS worker for 20 years.
Okay.
And it seems to me the first verses or so, it's the offender talking to Ada, asking for forgiveness. I let you down.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's kind of juxtaposed with the singer being pure and
right.
pure voice and
yeah.
strong major chords in the song. It kind of confuses me a little bit.
That is very interesting. I had thoughts never crossed my mind. Been teaching this song for years. Very interesting.
I always thought that she was singing to an ex-lover. And that one of them had betrayed the other.
Right.
But I didn't get the child abuse part.
Well, you mentioned it.
Right. That's right.
Why it hit me.
Yes, right. And I throw it out there because it, again, appears to be part of the history of the song's genesis. That doesn't necessarily mean that's what the song is about.
Right.
Songwriting is a tricky business. And in a sense, the song I find more meaningful going into it with that knowledge. But that's not the same thing as agreeing that, you know, there has to be a monolithic reading of the song that sort of reduces it to that somehow.
Yeah, I took it the same way he did. I was a little confused as to why it was female voice who was the offender singing.
But Sarah McLachlan does very interesting things. And one of her, one of her creepiest songs, Take Your Breath Away, I think is the name of the song, is actually, the text is drawn entirely from letters that she received from a stalker. And there's this fellow who is stalking her, and I don't even really want to get into the song, but I will be the one to hold you down, kiss you so hard, I'll take your breath away. These creepy, creepy lyrics about this fellow who was convinced that he was going to win her affections this way. This is where her lyrical material comes from. So where's the subjectivity there? I mean, it's Sarah McLachlan performing a song, sort of assuming the persona of a stalker of her. It's a very sort of confusing thing. And the question of whether a female could, in this case, assume the role, verse by verse, of somebody who might sort of biologically been a male player in this story.
Another tack, the way I heard it, her being a female, and if the victim of the abuse is a female, which is another assumption we're all making. The victim of the abuse could be a male. Idea, who knows if that's a male or a female name? I think that's part of the mystery of this. We don't know if it's a lover or if it's a child or if it's who, but there's also, in abuse situations, there's also the other parent or another loved person who knows what's happening.
Right.
Maybe, and doesn't respond, doesn't do something. The mother who doesn't get the children out, or the father who doesn't get the children out, and or an aunt or a friend or somebody who sees it and denies it, and this could, or a dear friend of the person who's being abused, if they're being abused as an adult, who doesn't say, "You're coming and staying with me until we can find you a place, and we're getting you away from your abuser right now."
Yeah.
They let it continue, and so it's not. I could hear that voice being this voice rather than the abuser themselves.
Great.
When you were talking about when you were asking what she does to buy moral authority as a performer, one of the things I was reminded of in hearing this song is that part of her singing style is, her voice as a singer is to allow her voice to break when changing notes, which gives the impression of a barely contained emotion that I think makes people think I hear that voice as very authentic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, that seems absolutely right to me. That of course she's in complete control, she can do anything with this instrument she wants to, but she acts as though it's constantly on the edge, and she sort of imparts that somehow. This sense of authenticity, this kind of couched vulnerability to the sound itself. Terrific. Wonderful.
Also in the voice, there's that kind of breathy texture.
Yeah. That accomplishes what, you think? I mean,
it accomplishes kind of an otherworldliness.
Yeah.
And there are a couple other things that I noticed that kind of added to that. There was that kind of super chorused guitar right? With that whang.
Yep.
That almost didn't sound like a guitar. Mm-hmm. Almost sounded kind of like a spaceship sound. You know?
Yeah.
When you get to the end, when the organ sneaks in, there's these high whistles that kind of just get held out for a while.
Yeah. But why do you think the guitar is handled that way? I mean, you're right. It's a sort of weird super chorus guitar sound. What's that all about? I mean, does that add up to vulnerability, to otherworldliness? What do you get out of that guitar sound?
I don't know.
Okay, I don't either. And Paul, being a maker of this music, by the way, I think probably comes with the perspective that most makers of this music have, that we did it this way because it sounded cool. And most of the time, that's the best answer there is. I mean, I remember in the course of my rock and roll class that I teach at the University of Minnesota, there are hundreds of kids in this class, and naturally they all have different perspectives. There's one kid in a band called Catchpenny, which is slowly making their way into the very highest circles of professional production and session people and so forth in the Twin Cities. They're just on the verge of getting a major label contract. It's a very exciting thing to watch. But they have just produced an album in a studio with a big-time producer, and he was sitting down playing me, with the guitarist of this band, sat me down and played me a couple tracks of this thing, and we were listening to this song, and about a minute and a half into the song, he said, "Oh, wait, here comes the Mario Brothers part." And I listened, and sure enough, there's this little sort of Mario Brothers, video game sound that just sort of sneaks in. And I said, "Oh, what's that doing there?" And he said, "I don't know, I just thought it sounded neat." That's how most of these things work. Right. So we don't necessarily have to justify the super chorus guitar in any way, except, it just sort of caught somebody's ear. It seemed like a way to get the sound they wanted.
Did you think the ha 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 thing had some satirical kind of thing, or I just thought it sounded kind of cool?
I just thought it sounded kind of cool. I was hoping I actually, honestly, just noticed it at 6:30 this morning as I was kind of listening to this song. But there are these things.
I never would have heard it if you had avoided it.
I never had. But there are these things that producers think sort of enrich textures and just sort of propel songs along. The art of production, by the way, we tend to speak dismissively of certain music, the Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, whatever, as being overproduced or as being the work of producers. I think we must get away from this language. Producers are professionals too. Producers are gifted musicians too. And yes, they do have a strong hand in generating the overall sound you hear. But the art of production, the craft of music production, has gotten, it's reached points that is simply baffling to most of us. That, it's an extremely obscure art. But, much of the work being done by a lot of pop music is just being done by, producers and their little ideas. And I'm not sure what it all means, but another thought here.
Well, along the lines of the ha-has and the production, this song isn't a really great example of it, but one thing that I've noticed Sarah McLachlan doing, and a lot of female performers that are like her, like Enya and Lorena McKennitt, much of their music has many layers of their one voice, where you are just surrounded on every side by the voice of this one woman. And I think when you're talking about how does this performer gain moral authority through the production, production allows the one voice to become omnipresent, a divine quality in the recording.
Yeah, that's a great thought.
Say, Peter?
Yeah.
What happens if one reading of this song is that it's the creepy reading, in which the entire thing is the attempt of the abuser to, in a very quickly does the confession of sin, and the rest of it is a way to go back to a state of innocence and guiltlessness.
Yeah.
And then in that sense, it's more abuse.
Yeah.
The song itself is an abusing song.
Well, that's a horrible thought. it does seem to me as sound a reading as many of the others we could pluck up here.
In the lyrics alone, you said there's nothing particularly Christian, but there is something particularly Lutheran, I think, in the refrain that we are born innocent, we are still innocent. It's easy, we all falter. It's very similar use to set the tattoo, that we are innocent, and
yeah.
I think Lutherans, among many others, kind of forget that's the promise of our forgiveness, and
yeah.
For those of us baptized, that's the promise of baptism, that you get to know yourself as innocent now.
Right.
Instead of wallowing in the guilt and the shame of it all,
right.
Lutherans are really good at wallowing, which is bizarre, because because really this is more of a truly Lutheran attitude that we are in fact innocent because of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's still easy to falter, and it's easy. I know people have a problem with equating sin with mistakes or faltering, but in a pop jargon sort of way, that's what this is saying, that we still have those daily stumbling blocks that we stumble on, and yet we are still innocent, and I think that's a very Lutheran Christian anyway.
Great.
Specific thing.
Very nice people. Now, what about the nature of this innocence musically? And I don't want to be too reductionist here, and I don't want to suggest that we have to simplify things, again, down to a single, sort of solid, unilinear reading. But there's something a little weird about the way that innocence keeps getting put forward musically. I mean, as we work our way into the choruses, there's just nothing more fun than hearing me sing a Sarah McLachlan song. We have this very nice, solid tonic. That's our tonic chord, our home chord. And with the word, we're plucked away from it to the most dissonant chord that exists in tonal music, a diminished seventh chord. It's a chord where all the notes are the same distance apart, if there are any music theorists, and they're all a minor third apart. And so it's a chord that can go absolutely anywhere. Not only is it dissonant itself, but it's utterly disorienting. You can go from that chord to almost any other chord you want, and it'll sound like... it'll sound as though it resolved properly. It's a highly tricky chord in the musical landscape. We don't hear it much in pop music, and here it is. And the second time we get this word innocent, believe me, we are still innocent. That's what we assume is going to happen, but no, we get a deceptive cadence. We are still innocent. That is, we end up on this sort of tragic G minor chord instead of that E flat that we wanted. What does that accomplish? The fact that innocence, this literal word innocence, always kind of takes us to the wrong place. It seems to be taking us away from stability rather than back toward it. Is that merely poignant and meaningful, or is it actually undercutting the text somehow? I don't know the right answer, but what does that accomplish?
Well, that might fit in with the reading we heard from...
Right, from on high, yeah.
This is kind of a... You know, I understand in abusive situations that the abuser repeatedly, you know, confesses and regains the confidence of the victim to continue with the abuse, and that would kind of fit in with that reading, because the innocence that he's professing is really not a resolution. It's
mm-hmm.
just going to lead to another round of the same thing.
So we could go there if we wanted to. It sounds very Paul.
From a craft point of view, it might be just a simple way of saying both one thing and its opposite at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being economical with your 3 minutes.
Right. And so why does she want so much to say the opposite of that thing that she's saying? I mean, that is she trying to sort of undercut this idea of innocence so we won't walk out with an easy answer? Do you think that's...
I think so. I mean, I think she's saying that we're innocent, but it doesn't feel innocent, maybe. I don't know.
Great. You had your hand up first, but she's my mom, so she wins.
That's all.
Go ahead.
Well, I hear with that kind of dissonance, and you said, you know, it leads us somewhere that we don't, it's uneasy footing.
Yeah.
To me, that just leads to the mystery.
Great. Great. Okay.
He told me the answer.
Yeah, very good. Then we may come back to that.
Well, I have a different take on this.
Yeah.
I read this as two young lovers who are very inexperienced,
mm-hmm.
and there are strong moral values,
mm-hmm.
and they get too close,
mm-hmm.
and they want that innocence back.
Very good.
They're kind of crying for that innocence, and they break up,
mm-hmm.
and there's this lostness.
Great.
But you only have that innocent path to be
right.
Okay.
But you can't go back. Very good.
Yeah. I guess I'm still kind of staying with the darker view of it also. I get the same feeling listening to her sing that I get when I listen to Hey Jude.
Yeah.
It's got that same thing, but it's just sort of this coaxing. I think Hey Jude is a drug dealer saying, it's okay, put the needle in your arm. It sort of has the same feel. It's easy, let it go.
That's good. Well, very good. And we certainly are learning, among other things, about the, you know, the polyvalence of pop music. I mean, this idea that somehow it has to be, the mystery of these chords isn't about undercutting their meaning. And it isn't about saying, well, here's the answer that the words give us, but we all kind of know in our hearts where the music lives, that this isn't the real answer, but rather to retain a sense of the mystery. Yes, this is a diminished seventh chord that can go anywhere. That isn't sad. That isn't unstable and uncertain. That's just what we have to deal with when we deal with something like, say, forgiveness, or like transubstantiation or consubstantiation, or that sort of weird thing that Episcopalians believe, which is kind of this fuzzy thing in the middle. We don't know what happens when the host is elevated, but something does. You know, and if you want to kind of retain that sense of just the mystery of it all, the mystery of, say, forgiveness, you know, you have to do something mysterious. It can't be too pat. And that certainly is one way we can go. But another way is to say, yes, the words are persistently undercut. We're never allowed to actually have confidence in what's said. Very nice. Good thoughts. Other things about the timbre of her voice, anything else? It's a neat song. And persistently beautiful. You know, first and foremost, a beautiful sound. We don't have all the time in the world, but I want to go to another Sarah McLachlan song. This is the song, a song from the same album that I think may have been the song that really established her. I mean, it was the first song of hers I began to hear in the top 40. And I'm not sure it's nearly as provocative a song as Adia. I'm not quite sure what to say about this song. The subject matter is extremely strange. I have not ever heard a pop song on this subject, and I'm sure they're out there. But it appears to be a song written for a friend of hers who's involved in a Wiccan tradition or some sort of New Age tradition of one kind or another. That is, she is addressing, in detail, advice to a friend who is involved in a sort of faith system that strikes her as sort of manufactured and improbable and groundless. You know, you come out at night, that's when the energy comes and the dark side's light and the vampires roam. You strut your Rasta wear and your suicide poem and across from a faith that died before Jesus came, you're building a mystery. Now, that may not be all the song is about. There are also sort of implications that there's a sort of, that these people are lovers, the person she's talking to, that's part of the, that's part of what's on the table here, though that remains a little bit murky. It's a very strange subject matter. And again, we might look at this as sort of divine work if you perceive it as one of the tasks of Christianity, and not all of us do, but if you perceive one of the tasks of Christianity to sort of take, whatever, level its sights on kind of ad hoc, late coming religions that claim to be revivals of earlier kinds of religions. You know, if you think this is one of the jobs of Christianity, then, you know, this is doing Christian work. We think, for example, the way that black metal has evolved in Scandinavia, that Norwegian black metal is these black metal artists see themselves not as really Satanists, that's not what they are, they're sort of pagans who are hearkening back to a happier day of paganism in Norway before the Christians took over and killed everybody and set up some Christian churches. Norway did have a nice, stable indigenous religion, and it was taken away by the Christians. And so the Norwegian black metal artists, they don't worship Satan, they're pagans, and they're trying to reclaim this religion. And unhappily, they have burned down dozens of old Christian churches in the process, murders are involved, that it's turned into a horrible, crime-ridden scene, this new pagan thing. And so we can say, for example, that Christianity really should speak out against this, that it looks good on paper. I mean, nobody wants to say the Norwegians shouldn't get their paganism back, yet it's just so violent, and so it just seems such an unlikely way to try to recover a religion. And that's obviously not quite what's being talked about here, but it's perhaps that kind of thing that we're dealing with, is somebody who has an idea that they're tapping into a more ancient religious tradition. Now, I by no means want to say that one cannot tap responsibly into old religious traditions. One of my best friends is a Wiccan, and there's nothing wrong, you know, with sort of shaping a meaningful life around such a practice. But Sarah McLachlan still sort of puts these challenges on the table. With all that said, let's give it a listen. One thing that we notice that perhaps discourages us a bit is just how often Sarah McLachlan seems to fall into the same old games. That Adia, part of what makes Adia so haunting and so fetching is these mysterious opening chords. That is, that we have on the one hand a motion from here in the long haul up to here, which is as though we're moving from motion from a sad area, you know, the minor mode up to this. And at the same time, we make it through a plagal cadence that sounds to a Christian like an amen. And so it's a very satisfying progression, and that's how Adia starts. Adia, I do believe I fail you. And naturally, here we have, you come out at night. That's when and it goes on like that, but this is the same chord progression at work here, too. She's very fond of this chord progression. It shows up prominently one other place on this album. Okay, cut her some slack. It's a very good song. But let's listen to this thing. This is what we make of it. A very different sort of timbre from Adia. It's up to different things, more a guitar-oriented song than a piano-oriented song. Let's just see what we make of it. There's one line of the song that I've seen fit to excise and that we will not be either listening to or reading. But, you know, whatever. Just didn't seem right for this audience. Backwards and then so it goes. Ponder it if you like. do with it.
Yeah. The trappings mentioned in the song, dark side, vampires, suicide poem, cross, razor wire shrine, I think those are all the trappings of the goth subculture.
Yeah.
I've got a bunch of goth friends in Minneapolis, and I think they've got all that stuff.
Okay.
And more.
Right. Fantastic. Yeah, and the black makeup and the leather gear and whatever. What about the razor wire? Do folks have razor wire lying around the house? I mean,
what the heck is
more metaphorically,
and what is
that? Tattoos would look like razor wire.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Very
right.
Interesting. And Rasta wear. I mean,
what is it?
I assume it's the sort of attire you'd see Rastafarian in, but
Jamaican,
I don't know.
Jamaican dreadlocks.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Fluffy hats.
Yeah. Sounds great. Now, I don't know, I mean, I certainly have goth students and some very good goth-oriented students. What is this as a kind of shaping device? What is, I mean, is there a belief system at the heart of the goth movement, or is it just kind of a fashion thing? Do you happen to know?
Well, I keep asking about this, and it's a fascination with darkness.
Yeah.
They can be good people.
Yeah.
But I think there's a tragic worldview involved.
Right.
And maybe it's covering oneself with the images of darkness almost as like a gargoyle on a church, warding off the darkness by
very nice.
Starting to look like it.
Yeah. Great. I do think many of us in the outside world who are not part of scenes like the goth scene or who don't spend time listening to, say, death metal, this sort of recent development, the last 20 years or so, since the work of a band, Mayhem or Slayer, I mean, some of these early bands kind of got death metal going, probably profoundly misunderstand what those kids are up to. I was at a concert recently. I've been doing some work on a certain British black metal band, a sort of satanic metal band. Cradle of Filth is the headline. But I was at a Cradle of Filth concert, and although they're a sort of stylized black metal operation, the band opening for them, and one of the best respected bands in the business, was Arch Enemy, one of the two bands opening for them. Arch Enemy is a death metal band, more than a black metal band. They're not so into religion at all. They're just fascinated with images of death and sort of, flesh in a state of decay and degradation. They have a female lead singer who just brings up the most interesting sounds out of her voice. But one goes to such a concert, and there is, of course, this sort of mosh pit out in the middle. I mean, there's 200 of the kids are doing nothing there, but just kind of in the middle, smashing into each other and dancing around. But if somebody's shoe comes off, if somebody finds a shoe, the first person to find it will pick it up and just hold it over their head and walk around the crowd until they can find the owner of the shoe and get it back to whoever it belongs to. And if anybody is hurt, which, happens, they're immediately kind of, path clears, off they go. Everybody's just there taking care of one another. And I've got three kids, and if I find that my kids are interested in going to things like death metal concerts of this kind, well, that's not ever going to be my favorite music in the world, but it's a perfectly happy, life-affirming, sort of mutually supportive operation that these kids are involved in. And you think I'm kidding. I mean, this is that it really is, in many ways, a very sort of life-affirming, a very life-affirming scene. And the whole fixation with death, it's I think it simply isn't as dangerous as most of us on the outside sort of look at it and think. It's an entertainment form. And I think, in general, it's not nearly as dangerous as the kinds of sort of lifestyle decisions that many bands in the late 60s were encouraging. Emily?
I might also argue that it might be a little healthier than the mainstream aversion to death. We don't want to talk about death. We're going to pretend it's not going to happen. We're going to hold it at bay as long as we can.
Don't take kids to funerals.
And we don't take kids to funerals. We don't, we need to protect ourselves from death. Instead of, again, if
right.
we actually take the Christian message seriously, death is the doorway. It's
right.
the beginning of new life. It's
yeah.
not, why are we afraid of it?
Yeah.
Instead
yeah.
of embracing it as the mystery,
right.
as something, in fact, to be, not like we go looking for it, but something we could be vaguely excited about
yeah.
doing.
Yeah.
And I think it is a hugely misunderstood culture
right.
Because it's dark. And Christians, again, have this thing where we have, in our dualistic thinking, if Jesus Christ is the light, dark is bad.
Right.
And we can't, there's this thing where if you elevate darkness, that's evil.
Yeah.
And it's just not, I don't think it's true.
Right, right.
But we can't get out of our dualistic.
Right. And I just had to register here that the band I'm working on, Cradle of Filth, and a certain song of theirs, From the Cradle to Enslave, about how all of mankind is ultimately going to be sort of conquered by forces of evil, or most of mankind will. You listen to this and you think, my gosh, what a terrible vision, you know, about sort of the triumph of evil and stuff like that. And then you sort of get through it line by line, and about 98% of this song's genetic code it shares with the Book of Revelation. That is, it's really sort of densely, sort of literate, well, and also with Paradise Lost, with Milton's Paradise Lost. It's densely literate, thoughtful music that really is basically Christian in its outlook, not exactly colored that way. But it's not that these are sort of non-Christian concerns somehow. They're the ones keeping that narrative alive. They're the ones who are actually getting out there and reading their Milton, reading their Bible, and actually sort of writing lyrics about it instead of ignoring it. I'm sorry, there's another hand.
There's this, you know, tremendous fascination with the dark side. And in creativity, writing or composing or imagining the dark side is really easy to do a lot of times. This spring in Minnesota, we had a Red Lake Indian Reservation. I know it got national attention, but a student, you know, it had a website that was discovered afterwards, a website that he created. And once the website was published, there was something like the next day 350,000 hits on this website. And 350,000 people are not going to do the same thing that this boy did.
Yeah.
You know, but there's just this fascination and intrigue and the vampires and the razors and the this and the that. I mean, that's just a very, very fascinating kind of thing for young people, for big people, people, any people.
Right.
And it's always been that way. Always, always. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's dangerous.
Right.
I think it's just curiosity.
Right.
It's dangerous when you're depressed.
Right, right.
And there's always just plain old bugging your parents. I mean, which one of you would like to have your kids listening to Cradle of Filth? I mean, it's, you know, nothing seems more irritating. There's another hand up.
I was just going to say, getting back to the song a little bit, too, it seems to me that this is partly about you're not letting, you know, you're into all these things, and yet you're really not letting me into things.
Right.
You know, and so there is this sort of them versus us.
Yeah.
Piece of
fascinating. Fascinating. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Somehow Sarah McLachlan is seeming a lot less interesting than these other topics that have come up. But is there, and by the way, I'm not trying to be dismissive of music that is explicitly, you know, just evil. I mean, that is the sort of pledging allegiance to the forces of evil. I'm not sure that music is especially dangerous either, but I do understand that it is offensive to folks of a certain sensibility, Christian sensibility, say. And yes, there are songs out there with titles like Hymn to Satan about how, you know, you're going to sort of pledge allegiance to the forces of darkness. I'm not saying that this is all just good, clean fun. It's, I don't know. I mean, obviously there are many things out there to be sort of staunchly disapproved of, but I think the culture is widely misunderstood by people who don't have any familiarity with its texts. That is, that most of those songs that one finds so upsetting just aren't about the things you think they're about. And they're certainly not being sort of taken in by those who consume them the way that we think they're being taken in. So it's just a culture that's very easily misunderstood. About Sarah McLachlan, is there more to say about the song? I really don't have much to say about this song. I'm not sure what to say about it. What's up with that backwards guitar? Again, is that just kind of a cool idea? Does it mean anything?
She's not buying the dark arts friend. It's almost a little cynical, a little sarcastic. You're building a mystery. You're making this whole thing up yourself. You're going out, you're making all these efforts. Plays the music backwards, which we all know is, you know, invokes Satan to play music backwards. You know, she kind of throws that in.
Yeah, great. That, very interesting. By the way, what a bunch of tangents we're on. Yes, there is this great sort of story that all this music released between about 1968 and 1975, if played backwards, contains all kinds of satanic messages. there's a website dedicated to Led Zeppelin. Little Led Zeppelin is played backwards. Have you ever been on this website? So you can get little snippets of Led Zeppelin played backwards along with the text of what they supposedly say. And I gotta say, it isn't satanic. I mean, if you want somebody to understand something, don't do it backwards. It's just the human mind simply can't absorb that kind of thing. But still, it's just neat as it can be, because many of the messages really are sort of phonetically there. I mean, very elaborate things about sort of Satan doing this and that. And it just, I mean, purely by coincidence, nobody could plan this sort of
we
thing.
We can do that with your recorded voice. Let's play it backwards.
That's absolutely
right. I think I heard him say that backwards.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
absolutely. But just as a study of language, just of sort of the phonetics of the English language and how many things just happen to kind of make sense backwards, it is fascinating. I love this business. It's just, I mean, it's dumb to think that anybody, never mind. But I mean, you couldn't understand two words out of my mouth if they were played backwards. You couldn't make head or tails of them. If I spoke as clearly as I could, you wouldn't understand your own name played backwards. So I don't know. Not a very clever way for Satan to do his work in the world, but but other things about this song. I mean, so the backwards guitar—that's a very interesting thought. But that's what it's alluding to. That it's get at one of those satanic messages. That she's somehow alluding to this tradition. Great. Other thoughts?
I don't know if I should let this be known or not, but I'm reading a book right now entitled "The Jesus Mysteries." Was the original Jesus, in quotes, a pagan god? And it talks about exactly this this idea that Jesus, the character of Jesus, is based on pre-Judeo-Christian faith beliefs, things that we now call pagan in a derogatory term.
Right.
And I find it interesting, her line, across from a faith that died before Jesus came, the faith, the multiple different faiths of that, which were rather universal. It was a lot of similar beliefs, multi-culturally, but very much the same mythology, used the cross as a symbol of the unity of the universe, essentially, all four directions coming to one center and multiple other images that go along with the cross. And it's not so much that those faiths died as they were stomped out by Christians. And so I find it hard as a Christian who's trying to reconcile Christianity with the pre-existing faith groups in this country and in indigenous people around the world, and what Christianity and Judaism have done historically to stomp out other faith groups, to say that it died and therefore it's insignificant, or it's lesser, or it's not something we need to pay attention to, when, whether you believe that Jesus was a pagan god or not, we have to know that many of our practices, many of our sacred holy days, all of these things come from the pagan calendar and pagan rituals that did exist before Jesus Christ walked the earth. So I find parts of this song, either she's demeaning these pre-faiths, or she's lifting them up as, because they were called mysteries in many different cultures. And you're building a mystery, and maybe this man, or whoever it is trying to piece together these ancient faith traditions and is putting them together, not building like you're making it up, but you are reconstructing.
Right.
And maybe putting it in a more positive light, reconstructing an ancient understanding of God that has been suppressed and demonized by what we now call Christianity, even though original Christianity was based on many of those same principles and thoughts.
Terrific. Yeah, and it may not have died a natural death.
Right.
Yeah, great.
Wasn't Sarah McLaughlin the founder of the Lilith Fair? I don't think I can think of a friend who defines themselves as Wiccan who wouldn't have a Sarah McLaughlin disc on their shelf.
And do you want to tell us about the Lilith Fair, by the way? Not all of us in the room.
I guess I don't know enough about it.
I don't too, really.
But it was a festival of arts and music that very deeply feminist in character, but also, I think the word is eco-feminist. I mean,
yeah.
there's a spiritual and earth spirituality going along with it.
Right. Great, Emily. You.
I was going to say, it's kind of an eco-feminist concentration of bands and music and art and things like that that travels around the country with tons of big labels and not so big labels, and it's been very popular.
And it's hard to look too grimly on them. It seems to me like a wonderful operation. I've never been to one of them, but certainly a lot of great talent brought together, Adam. Well, that bell is telling us something. We've got to wrap this up. But for those of you who have been involved both in today's conversation and the conversations of the past week, it's been a great time. Thank you all very much. And have a good weekend from here on out.
Thank you.